antidote to Caesar's artfully partisan commentaries on the Civil War, written to match his commentaries on the Gallic War, and to some of the high-flown rhetoric and big principles that the clash between Caesarians and Pompeians still evokes. Civil War had its seedy side too. Part of Cicero's indecision in 49 BCE was caused not by political ambivalence, but by almost farcical ambition. He had only just returned from Cilicia and was keen for the Senate to award him a triumph to celebrate his successful skirmish in the province a year earlier, and the rules demanded that he neither enter the city nor dismiss his official staff until the decision on the award had been made. He was anxious about his family and uncertain whether his wife and daughter should remain in Rome. Could they be useful to him there? Would there be enough food for them? Would it give the wrong impression for them to stay in the city when other rich women were leaving? In any case, if he was to stand a chance of a triumph, he had little option but to spend a few months traipsing around outside Rome, increasingly inconvenienced and embarrassed by his detachment of official bodyguards, who were still carrying the drooping laurel leaves that he had been awarded to celebrate his little victory. Eventually, he accepted the inevitable. The senators had more pressing matters on their mind than his bauble, as he sometimes called it. He would give up any hope of a triumph and join Pompey. Even when he returned from those inglorious few months on the front line, he still faced the personal ruptures, uncertainties, and spillover violence that were part and parcel, day to day, of the big story of civil war. There were quarrels with his brother, Quintus, who seemed to be trying to make his own peace with Caesar by bad-mouthing Cicero. There were suspicions about the killing in Greece of one of his friends, a prominent adversary of Caesar, who, in an after-dinner fight, had been fatally stabbed in the stomach and behind the ear. Was this just a personal quarrel about money, as Cicero suspected, for the killer was known to be short of cash, or was Caesar somehow behind the death? Violence apart, even playing his cards right and maintaining good personal relations with the winning side could prove irksome. It was never more irksome than when a couple of years later Cicero ended up entertaining Caesar to dinner in one of his seaside estates on the Bay of Naples, where many wealthy Romans from the city had luxury getaways. He gives a wry description of all the trouble it involved in a letter to his friend Atticus from the end of 45 BCE, which is also one of the most vivid pictures to survive of Caesar off duty, and a particularly favourite moment in Cicero's career for Gore Vidal centuries later. Caesar was travelling with a battalion of no fewer than 2,000 soldiers as a guard and escort, which was an awful burden for even the most generous and tolerant host. A billeting rather than a visit, as Cicero puts it. And that was in addition to Caesar's large civilian following of slaves and ex-slaves. Cicero explains that he had three dining rooms laid up for visiting senior staff alone and made appropriate arrangements for those further down the social pecking order, while Caesar took a bath and had a massage before he reclined to dine in the formal Roman fashion. He turned out to have a large appetite, partly because he had been following a course of emetics, which was a popular regime of detoxification among wealthy Romans, involving regular vomiting, and he enjoyed urbane conversation more about literature than about anything serious. How his own slaves and staff coped with this invasion, Cicero does not stop to say, or perhaps did not notice, but he congratulated himself that the evening had passed off well, even though he did not relish a repeat. My guest was not the sort to whom you would say, "Please drop by again when you are next around." Once is enough. The best one can observe is that entertaining a victorious Pompey would almost certainly have been just as much bother. Cicero's letters also reveal that the trials of war and the demands of receiving a dictator were only one part of his troubles at the time. Between Caesar's crossing of the Rubicon and his assassination on the Ides of March, 44 BCE, Cicero's family and household fell apart. In those 5 years, he divorced Terentia, his wife of 30 years, and quickly remarried. He was aged 60. His new bride, Publilia, was about 15 years old, and the relationship lasted only a few weeks before he sent her back to her mother. Meanwhile, his daughter, Tullia, was divorced from her third husband, Publius Cornelius Dolabella, an enthusiastic supporter of Caesar. Tullia was pregnant at the time of the divorce and died early in 45 BCE, shortly after giving birth to a son who only briefly survived her. Her previous child by Dolabella had been born prematurely and had also died, just a couple of weeks old. Cicero was engulfed in grief, which did not help his relationship with his new bride, as he retreated to be alone on one of his more isolated estates and to plan how to commemorate his daughter. He was soon busy reflecting on how to give her some kind of divine status. As he put it, he wanted to ensure her apotheosis. Husbands and wives. Roman marriage was, in essence, a simple and private business. Unlike in the modern world, the state played little part in it. In most cases, a man and a woman were assumed to be married if they claimed that they were married, and ceased to be married if they, or if one of them, claimed they no longer were. That, plus a party or two to celebrate the union, was probably all there was to it for the majority of ordinary Roman citizens. For the wealthier, there were often more formal and more expensive wedding ceremonies, featuring a relatively familiar lineup for such a rite of passage. Special clothes, brides traditionally wore yellow, songs and processions, and the new wife being carried over the threshold of the marital home. Considerations of property bulked larger for the rich too, in particular a dowry that the father of the bride provided to be returned in the event of divorce. One of Cicero's problems in the 40s BCE was that he had been forced to repay Terentia's dowry. While the cash-strapped Dolabella seemed not to have repaid Tullia's, or at least not in full. Marriage to young Publilia would have held out the prospect of a substantial fortune to compensate. The main purpose of marriage at Rome, as in all past cultures, was the production of legitimate children, who automatically inherited Roman citizen status if both parents were citizens, or if they satisfied various conditions governing intermarriage with outsiders. That is what lies at the heart of the story of the Sabine Women, which depict the first marriage in the new city as a process of legitimate rape for the purpose of procreation. The same message was paraded repeatedly on the tombstones of wives and mothers throughout Roman history. One epitaph written sometime in the mid-second century BCE, commemorating a certain Claudia, perfectly captures the traditional image. "Here is the unlovely grave of a lovely woman," it reads. "She loved her husband with her heart. She bore two sons. One of these she leaves on earth, the other under the earth. She was graceful in her speech and elegant in her step. She kept the home, she made the wool. That's what there is to say." The proper role of the woman, in other words, was to be devoted to her husband, to produce the next generation, to be an adornment, to be a household manager, and to contribute to the domestic economy by spinning and weaving. Other commemorations single out for praise women who had remained faithful wives to only one husband throughout their lives, and emphasize female virtues of chastity and fidelity. Contrast the epitaphs of Scipio Barbatus and his male descendants, where it is military action, political office-holding, and prominence in public life that capture the headlines. To what extent this image of the Roman wife was, at any period, more wishful thinking than an accurate reflection of social reality is impossible to know. There was undoubtedly a lot of vociferous nostalgia in Rome for the tough old days when wives were kept in their place. Ignatius Metellus took a cudgel and beat his wife to death because she had drunk some wine. insisted one first-century CE writer, with apparent approval, referring to an entirely mythical incident in the reign of Romulus. Even the Emperor Augustus took advantage of the traditional associations of woolworking in what was something like the ancient equivalent of a photo opportunity, by having his wife Livia pose at her loom in their front hall in full public view. But the chances are that those tough old days were in part the product of the imagination of later moralists, as well as a useful theme for later Romans to exploit in establishing their old-fashioned credentials. No less problematic is the competing image, prominent in the 1st century BCE, of a new style of liberated woman, who supposedly enjoyed a free social, sexual, often adulterous life, without much constraint from husband, family, or the law. Some of these characters were conveniently dismissed as part of the demi-monde of actresses, showgirls, escorts and prostitutes, including one celebrity ex-slave, Volumnia Cytheris, who was said to have been the mistress at one time or another of both Brutus and Mark Antony, so sleeping with both Caesar's assassin and his greatest supporter. But many of them were the wives or widows of high-ranking Roman senators. The most notorious of all was Clodia, the sister of Cicero's great enemy, Clodius, the wife of a senator who died in 59 BCE, and the lover of the poet Catullus, among a string of others. Terentia is rumoured to have had her suspicions about even Cicero's relations with Clodius's sister. She was alternately attacked and admired as a promiscuous temptress, scheming manipulator, idolised goddess, and borderline criminal. For Cicero, she was the Medea of the Palatine, a clever coinage linking the passionate, child-murdering witch of Greek tragedy with Clodia's place of residence in Rome. Catullus gave her the sobriquet Lesbia in his poetry, not only as camouflage, but in order to gesture back to the Greek poet Sappho from the island of Lesbos. Let's live, my Lesbia, and let's love. And the mutterings of stern old men, let's value them at a single penny. Give me 1,000 kisses, as one poem starts. Colourful as this material is, it cannot be taken at face value. Part of it is not much more than erotic fantasy. Part of it is a classic reflection of common patriarchal anxieties. Throughout history, some men have justified their domination of women by simultaneously relishing and deploring an image of the dangerous and transgressive female, whose largely imaginary crimes, sexual promiscuity, with the uncomfortable question marks this poses over any child's paternity, and irresponsible drunkenness, demonstrate the need for tight male control. The story of Ignatius Metellus's uncompromising line with his tipsy wife and the rumours of Clodia's wild parties are two sides of the same ideological coin. Besides, in many cases, the lurid descriptions of female criminality, power and excess are often not really about the women they purport to describe at all, but vehicles for a debate about something quite different. When Sallust focuses on a couple of women supposedly prominent in Catiline's conspiracy, he is using them as terrible symbols of the decadent immorality of the society that produced Catiline. Whether she was keener to squander her money or her reputation, it would have been hard to decide, he jibes about one senator's wife and the mother of one of Caesar's assassins, capturing what he saw as the spirit of the age. Cicero, for his part, used Clodia as a successful deflecting tactic in a tricky court case, where he was defending one of his dodgier young friends, who was also one of Clodia's ex-lovers, on a charge of murder. It is from the speech he delivered then that the vast majority of the disreputable details of her behaviour come. From the serial adulteries to the wild beach parties turned orgies, Cicero's aim was to shift the blame from his client by discrediting a jealous Clodia, making her a laughingstock, a bad influence on his client and the principal villain. It is hard to imagine that Clodia was an entirely celibate, stay-at-home wife and widow, but if she read Cicero's depiction of her in the comfort of her elegant Palatine home, whether she would have recognised herself is quite another matter. It is clear, however, that Roman women in general had much greater independence than women in most parts of the classical Greek or Near Eastern world, limited as it must seem in modern times. The contrast is particularly striking with classical Athens, where women of wealthy families were supposed to live secluded lives out of the public eye, largely segregated from men and male social life. The poor, needless to say, did not have the cash or the space to enforce any such divisions. There were, to be sure, uncomfortable restrictions on women in Rome too. The Emperor Augustus, for example, relegated them to the back rows of the theatres and gladiatorial arenas. The suites for women in public baths were usually markedly more cramped than those for men, and in practice male activities probably dominated the swankier areas of a Roman house. But women were not meant to be publicly invisible, and domestic life does not seem to have been formally divided into male and female spaces, with gendered no-go areas. Women also regularly dined with men, and not only the sex workers, escorts and entertainers, who provided the female company at classical Athenian parties. In fact, one of the early misdeeds of Verres turned on this difference between Greek and Roman dining practices. In the 80s BCE, when he was serving in Asia Minor, more than a decade before his stint in Sicily, Verres and some of his staff engineered an invitation to dinner with an unfortunate Greek, and after a considerable quantity of alcohol had been consumed, they asked the host if his daughter could join them. When the man explained that respectable Greek women did not dine in male company, the Romans refused to believe him and set out to find her. A brawl followed in which one of Verres' bodyguards was killed, and the host was drenched with boiling water. He was later executed for murder. Cicero paints the whole incident in extravagant terms, almost as a return to the rape of Lucretia, but it also involved a series of drunken misunderstandings about the conventions of female behaviour across the cultural boundaries of the empire. Some of the legal rules that governed marriage and women's rights at this period reflect this relative freedom. There were, it is true, some hard lines claimed on paper. It may have been a nostalgic myth that once upon a time a man had the right to cudgel to death his wife for the crime of drinking a glass of wine. But there is some evidence that the execution of a wife who was caught in adultery was technically within the husband's legal power. There is, however, not a single known example of this ever happening, and most evidence points in a different direction. A woman did not take her husband's name or fall entirely under his legal authority. After the death of her father, an adult woman could own property in her own right, buy and sell, inherit or make a will, and free slaves. Many of the rights that women in Britain did not gain till the 1870s. The only restriction was the need for an appointed guardian, tutor, to approve whatever decision or transaction she made. Whether Cicero was being patronising or misogynistic or, as some critics generously think, having a joke when he put this rule down to women's natural weakness in judgment is impossible to tell. But there is certainly no sign that for his wife it was much of a handicap. Whether she was selling a row of houses to raise funds for Cicero in exile or raking in the rents from her estates, no tutor is ever mentioned. In fact, one of the reforms of Augustus towards the end of the 1st century BCE or early in the next was to allow free-born citizen women who had borne 3 children to be released from the requirement to have a guardian. Ex-slaves had to have 4 to qualify. It was a clever piece of radical traditionalism. It allowed women new freedoms, provided they fulfilled their traditional role. Oddly, women had much less freedom when it came to the act of marriage itself. For a start, they had no real option whether to marry or not. The basic rule was that all free-born women were to be married. There were no maiden aunts, and it was only special groups such as the Vestal Virgins who opted or were compelled to remain single. What is more, the freedom a woman enjoyed in the choice of husband could be very limited, certainly among the rich and powerful, whose marriages were regularly arranged to cement alliances, whether political, social, or financial. But it would be naive to imagine that the daughter of a peasant farmer who wanted to do a deal with his neighbour, or the slave girl who was to be freed in order to marry her owner, a not uncommon occurrence, had much more to say in the decision. Marriage alliances underpinned some major developments in Roman politics in the late Republic. In 82 BCE, for example, Sulla attempted to secure Pompey's loyalty by giving him his stepdaughter as a wife, although she was married to someone else at the time and pregnant by him. The gamble did not pay off, because the poor woman almost immediately died in childbirth. 20 years later, Pompey sealed his agreement with Caesar in the Gang of Three by marrying Caesar's daughter, Julia. The stakes were not quite so high for Cicero and his daughter, Tullia, but it is clear that family advancement and good connections were always in Cicero's mind, even if things did not necessarily go his way. How to find a husband for Tullia was, he admitted, the thing that was worrying him most as he left Rome for the province of Cilicia in 51 BCE. After her two brief and childless marriages to men from distinguished families, one ending in the man's death, the other in divorce, a third match had to be arranged for her. On this occasion, Cicero's letters offer a glimpse of the negotiations as he canvassed a variety of suitable and less suitable candidates. One did not seem to be a serious proposition, another had nice manners. Of another he reluctantly wrote, "I doubt that our girl could be prevailed upon," acknowledging that Tullia had some say in the matter. But communications were a problem. As it took roughly 3 months for a letter to go from Cilicia to Rome and a reply to get back, it was hard for Cicero to keep control of the process, and he was more or less forced to leave the final decision to Terentia and Tullia. They picked none of his top choices, but the recently divorced Dolabella instead, another man with unimpeachable aristocratic credentials, and, by Roman accounts, an engaging rogue, inveterate seducer, and unusually short. "Who has tied my son-in-law to his sword?" is one of Cicero's best-remembered jokes. Arranged marriages of this kind were not necessarily grey and emotionless unions. It was always said that Pompey and Julia were devoted to each other, that he was devastated when she died in childbirth in 54 BCE, and that her death contributed to the political breakdown between Pompey and Caesar. The marriage, in other words, proved rather too successful for its intended purpose, and several of Cicero's earliest surviving letters to Terentia, whom he presumably married after some similar arrangement, are full of expressions of intense devotion and love, whatever emotions lay underneath. "Light of my life, my heart's desire, to think that you, darling Terentia, are so tormented when everyone used to go to you for help," he wrote to her from exile in 58 BCE. Equally, there are plenty of signs of marital squabbles, discontents and disappointments. Tullia soon found Dolabella more rogue than engaging, and within 3 years the pair were living apart. But the most persistently miserable marriage in Cicero's circle was that of his brother, Quintus, and Pomponia, the sister of Cicero's friend, Atticus. Predictably, and maybe unfairly, Cicero's letters throw most of the blame at the wife, but they also capture some of the arguments in uncannily modern terms. On one occasion, when Pomponia snapped, "I feel like a stranger in my own house," in front of guests, Quintus came out with the classic complaint, "There, you see what I have to put up with every day?" After 25 years of this, they eventually divorced. Quintus is supposed to have remarked, Nothing is better than not having to share a bed. Pomponia's reaction is unknown. It is, however, Cicero's short-lived second marriage to Publilia, then in her early to mid-teens, that sticks out from all other stories. Cicero and Terentia had divorced, probably at the beginning of 46 BCE. Whatever the main reasons for the split, and Roman writers came out with plenty of unreliable speculation on the subject, the latest surviving letter from him to her, written in October 47 BCE, suggests that relations between the two had changed. Just a few curt lines to a wife he had not seen for 2 years, partly because he had been away with Pompey's forces in Greece, it amounts to a couple of instructions for his imminent arrival. If there is no basin in the bathhouse, have one installed, is the basic gist. Just over a year later, after considering other possibilities, including Pompey's daughter and a woman he deemed the ugliest I have ever seen, Cicero married a girl at least 45 years his junior. Was this unusual? A first marriage at around 14 or 15 was not remarkable for a Roman girl. Tullia was betrothed to her first husband when she was 11 and married by 15. When Cicero, in 67 BCE, refers to betrothing dear little Tullia to Gaius Calpurnius Piso, he means exactly that, little. Atticus was already considering future husbands when his daughter was just 6. The elite might be expected to have arranged such alliances early. But there is plenty of evidence in the epitaphs of ordinary people for girls being married in their mid-teens and occasionally as young as 10 or 11. Whether or not these marriages were consummated is an awkward and unanswerable question. By the same token, men seem generally to have married for the first time in their mid to late 20s, with a standard age gap in a first marriage of something like 10 years, and some young brides would have found themselves married to an even older man on his second or third time around. Whatever the relative freedoms of Roman women, their subordination was surely grounded in that disequilibrium between an adult male and what we would call a child bride. That said, the age gap of 45 years causes puzzlement even at Rome. Why had Cicero done it? Was it just for the money? Or, as Terentia claimed, was it the silly infatuation of an old man? In fact, he faced some direct questions about why on earth, at his age, he was marrying a young virgin. On the day of the marriage, he is supposed to have replied to one of these, "Don't worry, she'll be a grown-up woman, mulier, tomorrow." The ancient critic who wrote this response thought it was a brilliantly witty way of deflecting criticism, and held it up for admiration. We are likely to put it somewhere on the spectrum between uncomfortably coarse and painfully bleak. One powerful marker of the distance between the Roman world and our own. Birth, death, and grief. Tragedy almost instantly overtook Cicero's new marriage. Tullia died soon after giving birth to Dolabella's son. Cicero appears to have been so incapacitated by grief that he retreated, without Publilia, to his property on the little island of Astura, off the coast south of Rome. His relationship with Tullia had always been very close, rather too intimate, according to the wild gossip of some of his enemies, indulging in the favourite Roman tactic of attacking an opponent through his sex life. It was certainly closer than that with her younger brother, Marcus, who, among other minor failings, never seems to have enjoyed the intellectual life and philosophy lectures in Athens to which his father had sent him. With Tullia's death, Cicero claimed he had lost the one thing that kept him committed to life. The production of children was a dangerous obligation. Childbirth was always the biggest killer of young adult women at Rome, from senators' wives to slaves. Thousands of such deaths are recorded, from high-profile casualties such as Tullia and Pompey's Julia, to the ordinary women across the empire, commemorated on tombstones by their grieving husbands and families. One man in North Africa remembered his wife who lived for 36 years and 40 days. It was her 10th delivery. On the 3rd day she died. Another, from what is now Croatia, put up a simple memorial to his fellow slave, and probably his partner, who suffered agonies to give birth for 4 days, and did not give birth, and so she died. To put this in a wider perspective, statistics available from more recent historical periods suggest that at least 1 in 50 women were likely to die in childbirth, with a higher chance if they were very young. They were killed by many of the disasters of childbirth that modern Western medicine has almost prevented, from hemorrhage to obstruction or infection. Though the lack of hospitals, where infections in early modern Europe easily passed from one woman to another, somewhat lessened that risk. Most women relied on the support of midwives. Beyond that, interventionist obstetrics probably only added to the danger. Caesarean sections, which, despite the modern myth, had no connection with Julius Caesar, were used simply to cut a live fetus out of a dead or dying woman. For cases where the baby was completely obstructed, some Roman doctors recommended inserting a knife into the mother and dismembering the fetus in the womb, a procedure which few women could possibly have come through safely. Pregnancy and childbirth must have dominated most women's lives, including those whom Roman writers chose to present as carefree libertines. A few would have been most concerned about their inability to conceive at all or to carry through a pregnancy. Romans almost universally blamed the woman for a couple's failure to have children, and this was one standard reason for divorce. Modern speculation, no more than that, is that her second husband may have divorced Tullia, who did not deliver a live baby until her late 20s, on precisely those grounds. The majority of women, however, faced decades of pregnancies without any reliable way, except abstinence, of preventing them. There were some makeshift and dangerous methods of abortion. Prolonged breastfeeding might have delayed further pregnancies for those who did not, as many of the wealthy did, employ wet nurses. And a wide variety of contraceptive potions and devices were recommended, which ranged from completely useless, wearing the worms found in the head of a particular species of hairy spider, to borderline efficacious, inserting almost anything sticky into the vagina. But most of their contraceptive efforts were defeated by the fact that ancient science claimed that the days after a woman ceased menstruating were her most fertile, when the truth is exactly the opposite. Those babies that were safely delivered had an even riskier time than their mothers. The ones that appeared weak or disabled would have been exposed, which may often have meant being thrown away on a local rubbish tip. Those that were unwanted met the same fate. There are hints that baby girls may generally have been less wanted than boys, partly because of the expense of their dowries, which would have been a significant element in the budget of relatively modest families too. One letter surviving on papyrus from Roman Egypt, written by a husband to his pregnant wife, instructs her to raise the child if it is a boy, but if it is a girl, discard it. How often this happened, and what the exact sex ratio of the victims was, is a matter of guesswork. But it was often enough for rubbish tips to be thought of as a source of free slaves. Those babies that were reared were still in danger. The best estimate, based largely on figures from comparable later populations, is that half the children born would have died by the age of 10 from all kinds of sickness and infection, including the common childhood diseases that are no longer fatal. What this means is that, although average life expectancy at birth was probably as low as the mid-20s, a child who survived to the age of 10 could expect a lifespan not wildly at variance from our own. According to the same figures, a 10-year-old would, on average, have another 40 years of life left, and a 50-year-old could reckon on 15 more. The elderly were not as rare as you might think in ancient Rome. But the high death rate among the very young also has the implications for women's pregnancies and family size. Simply to maintain the existing population, each woman, on average, would have needed to bear 5 or 6 children. In practice, that rises to something closer to 9 when other factors, such as sterility and widowhood, are taken into account. It was hardly a recipe for widespread women's liberation. How did these patterns of birth and death affect the emotional life within the family? It has sometimes been argued that, simply because so many children did not survive, parents would have avoided deep emotional investment in them. One chilling image of the father in Roman literature and storytelling stresses his control over his children, not his affection, while dwelling on the terrible punishment he could exact for their disobedience, even to the point of execution. There is, however, almost no sign of this in practice. It is true that a newborn baby may not have been viewed as a person as such until after the decision whether or not to rear it had been taken, and it had been formally accepted into the family. Hence, to some extent, the apparently casual attitude to what we would call infanticide. But the thousands of touching epitaphs put up by parents to their young offspring suggested anything but lack of emotion. "My little doll, my dear Mania, lies buried here. For just a few years was I able to give my love to her. Her father now weeps constantly for her," as the verses on one tombstone in North Africa run. Cicero, too, in 45 BCE, for a time, wept constantly over the death of Tullia, while documenting his grief and plans for her commemoration in a remarkable series of letters to Atticus. No details are known about Tullia's death, except that it happened at Cicero's country house at Tusculum, outside Rome, and nothing at all is known of her funeral. Cicero almost immediately retreated alone to his hideaway on the island of Astura, where he read all the philosophy he could get his hands on about loss and consolation, and even wrote a treatise on bereavement to himself, before deciding after a couple of months that he should return to the house where she had died. "I'm going to conquer my feelings and go to the Tusculum house, else I'll never go back there." By this stage he had already begun to channel his grief into her memorial, which was not to be a tomb, but a shrine or a temple, fanum, which in Latin has an exclusively religious meaning. His immediate concerns were with location, prominence, and future upkeep, and he was soon planning to buy an estate in the suburbs, near what is now the Vatican, on which to site the building, and was pre-ordering some columns. He was aiming, he insisted, at Tullia's apotheosis. By this he probably meant immortality in some general sense, rather than any full-blown claim that she was to become a god. But it is nevertheless another instance of the fuzzy boundary that in the Roman world lay between mortals and immortals, and of the way in which divine powers and attributes were used to express the prominence and importance of individual human beings. There is a certain irony, however, in the fact that while Cicero and his friends were increasingly anxious about the godlike honours being given to Caesar, Cicero was busy planning some kind of divine status for his dead daughter. But the project for the shrine in the end came to nothing, for the whole of the Vatican area became earmarked for a major piece of Caesar's urban redevelopment, and Cicero's chosen site was lost. Money matters. The houses on Astura and at Tusculum were only 2 of some 20 properties that Cicero owned in Italy in 45 BCE. Some were elegant residential mansions. In Rome he had a large house on the lower slopes of the Palatine Hill, a couple of minutes' walk from the Forum, where many of the topmost draw of the Roman elite, Clodia included, were his neighbours. His other houses were dotted throughout the peninsula, from Puteoli on the Bay of Naples, where he entertained Caesar to that rather crowded dinner party, to Formiae, further north, where he had another seaside villa. Some were small rest houses or lodges, strategically sited on roads between his far-flung larger properties, where he could stay overnight to avoid sleeping in seedy inns or lodging houses, or imposing on friends. Some, including his family estates at Arpinum, were working farms, even if they had a luxury residence attached. Others were straightforward money-making rental properties, such as the low-grade building from which even the rats had fled. Two large and even more lucrative blocks to let in central Rome had been part of Terentia's dowry, and in 45 BCE must recently have been returned on the divorce. The total value of this property portfolio was something in the order of 13 million sesterces. In the eyes of ordinary Romans, this was a vast holding, worth enough to keep more than 25,000 poor families alive for a year, or to provide more than 30 men with the minimum wealth qualification for standing for political office. But it did not put Cicero into the bracket of the super-rich. In reflecting on the history of extravagance, Pliny the Elder states that in 53 BCE, Clodius bought for almost 15 million sesterces the house of Marcus Aemilius Scaurus, one of Cicero's friends, and a somewhat disreputable officer of Pompey's in Judea in the 60s BCE. The remains of its basement have tentatively been identified, also on the Palatine slopes, near where the Arch of Titus still stands. They comprise about 50 small rooms and a bath, probably for slaves, and earlier generations of archaeologists confidently and wrongly identified them as a city centre brothel. At yet another level up, the property of Crassus was worth 200 million sesterces. With that, he could indeed have paid for his own army. Despite some imaginative attempts, not a single one of Cicero's properties has been firmly identified on the ground. Yet it is possible to get some idea of what they were like from his accounts, including his plans for improvement, and from contemporary archaeological remains. The rich residences of the late Republican elite on the Palatine Hill are generally very poorly preserved, for the simple reason that over the first century CE, the imperial palace that soon came to dominate the hill was built on top of them. Some of the most impressive traces from the earlier period are in the so-called House of the Griffins. These include several rooms of what must have been the ground floor of an impressive early 1st century BCE house, still partly visible within the foundations of the palatial structures on top, complete with brightly painted walls and simple mosaic pavements. In overall plan and design, this and the other Palatine houses were probably not all that different from the much better preserved remains at Pompeii and Herculaneum. The point about the residences of the Roman elite, whether of senators in Rome or of local bigwigs outside it, is that they were not private houses in modern terms. They did not, or not only, represent a place to escape from the public gaze. To be sure, there were some hideaways, such as Cicero's retreat on Astura, and some parts of the house were more private than others. But in many ways, domestic architecture was meant to contribute to the public image and reputation of the prominent Roman. And it was in his house that much of public business was done. The great hall, or atrium, the first room a visitor normally entered after walking through the front door, was a key location. Usually double volume, open to the sky, and designed to impress, with stuccos, paintings, sculptures, and impressive vistas off, it provided the backdrop to many encounters between the master of the house and a variety of subordinates, petitioners and clients, from ex-slaves needing help, to that visiting delegation from Teos who went from atrium to atrium trying to kiss the Roman's feet. Beyond that, on the standard plan, the house stretched back, with more entertaining rooms, dining areas, parlours cum bedrooms, cubicula, and covered walkways and gardens, if there was space. The walls featuring decorations to match their function, from large display paintings to intimate panels and erotica. For visitors, the further they were welcomed into the less public parts of the house, the more honoured they were. Business, with one's closest friends and colleagues, might be done, as Romans put it, in cubiculo, that is, in one of those small intimate rooms where one might sleep, though not exactly bedrooms in the modern sense. It is where, we might guess, the gang of three made their deals. The house and its decoration contributed to the image of its owner, but impressive display had to be carefully calibrated against the possible taint of excessive luxury. Eyebrows were raised, for example, when Scaurus decided to use in the atrium of his Palatine house some of the 380 columns that he had brought to decorate a temporary theatre he had commissioned for public shows. They were made of Lucullan marble, a precious Greek stone known in Rome after the man who first imported it, Lucius Licinius Lucullus, Pompey's immediate predecessor in the war against Mithridates, and they were each over 11 metres high. Many Romans felt that Scaurus had made a serious mistake in adorning his house in a luxurious style more appropriate to fully public display. Sallust was not the only one to imagine that immoral extravagance somehow underlay many of Rome's problems. On several occasions in his letters, Cicero can be found worrying about how to decorate his properties appropriately, how to project an image of himself as a man of taste, learning, and Greek culture, and how to source the artworks that he needed in order to do that, not always successfully. A tricky problem he faced in 46 BCE reveals some of his slightly fussy concerns. One of his unofficial agents had acquired for him in Greece a small collection of statues that was both too expensive — he could have bought a new lodge, he explains, for the price — and quite unfit for the purpose he had in mind. For a start, there was a statue of the god of war Mars, when Cicero was supposed to be presenting himself as the great advocate of peace. Worse, there was a group of Bacchantes, the uninhibited, ecstatic, drunken followers of the god Bacchus, which could not possibly be used to decorate a library as he wanted. You needed muses for a library, he explained, not Bacchantes. Whether Cicero managed to sell these sculptures on, as he hoped, or whether they ended up in a storeroom on one of his estates is not recorded. But the story is a pointer to the way the domestic, as well as the public, environment of Rome sucked in artworks, both antiques and replicas, in a brisk trade with the Greek world. The material remains of that trade are now best documented by the cargoes that did not make it in a series of shipwrecks of Roman trading vessels that divers discovered on the bed of the Mediterranean. One of the most stunning, probably to be dated sometime in the 60s BCE, to judge from the coins it was carrying, sank between Crete and the southern tip of the Peloponnese, near the island of Antikythera, hence its modern name, the Antikythera wreck. It was carrying bronze and marble sculptures, including one exquisite miniature bronze figure on a wind-up revolving base, luxury furniture, elegant bowls in glass and mosaic, and, most famous of all, the Antikytherean mechanism. This was an intricate bronze device with a clockwork mechanism, apparently designed to predict the movements of the planets and other astronomical events. Though rather a long way from the world's first computer, as it has occasionally been dubbed, it must have been destined for the library of some keen Roman scientist. The relationship between leading late republicans and their properties was in some ways, however, a curious one. Cicero and his friends strongly identified with their houses. Beyond the carefully planned arrangements of sculpture and artworks, the wax masks of their ancestors, Imagines, that were worn in funeral processions were displayed in the atria of aristocratic families, who sometimes had different sets or copies for their different properties. On the atrium wall, a painted family tree was one standard feature, and the spoils a man had taken in battle. The ultimate mark of Roman achievement might also be pinned up there for admiration. Conversely, if the political tide turned, the House could become almost a surrogate for aggression against its owner or an additional target. When Cicero went into exile in 58 BCE, not only did Clodius and his gangs destroy his property on the Palatine, but considerable damage was done to his properties at Formiae and Tusculum too. And he was not the first who was said to have suffered this kind of punishment. Towards the mythical beginning of a long line of such cases, a radical called Spurius Melius, in the mid-5th century BCE, was executed and his house pulled down, when, in a classic conservative Roman inference, his generosity to the poor raised suspicions that he was aiming at tyranny. Yet, in another way, the connection between family and house was surprisingly loose. Quite unlike, for example, the British aristocracy, whose traditions put great store by the continuity of ownership of their country houses, the Roman elite were always buying, selling, and moving. It is true that Cicero hung on to some family property in Arpinum, but he bought his Palatine house only in 62 BCE from Crassus, who may have owned it as an investment opportunity rather than as a residence. And before that, the house of Livius Drusus, where he was assassinated in 91 BCE, had stood on the site. Cicero's estates at Tusculum had passed from Sulla to a deeply conservative senator, Quintus Lutatius Catullus, and finally to a rich slave known to us only as Vettius in the 25 years before Cicero bought it in the early 60s BCE. Presumably, any masks in the atrium were packed up on the occasion of a sale and moved to the new property. But strangely, it was the custom that spoils of victory stayed with the house and did not move with the family of the man who had won them. In one of Cicero's later attacks on Mark Antony, he complains that Antony was living and drunkenly carousing in a house that had once belonged to Pompey, with rams from captured ships, probably seized in the campaign against the pirates, still adorning the entranceway. This pattern of property transfer raises several basic questions. The sums involved were very large. In 62 BCE, Cicero had to hand over 3.5 million sesterces for his new house on the Palatine. And there is almost no information about how this kind of payment was organized in practice. It is unlikely that Cicero's slaves simply wheeled truckloads of cash through the streets under armed guards. The whole transaction points instead, either to the use of gold bullion, which would at least have required fewer trucks, or more likely to some system of paper finance or bonds, and so to a relatively sophisticated banking and credit system underpinning the Roman economy, for which only fleeting evidence now survives. Even more basically, where did all the money come from in the first place? Just after buying the Palatine house, Cicero joked in a letter to his friend Publius Sestius that he was so up to his ears in debt that I'd be keen to join a conspiracy if there was one that would have me, a wry allusion to the Catilinarian conspiracy of the previous year. Loans certainly must have been part of it, but most of them had to be repaid, sometimes sooner rather than later. Cicero was, for example, keen to pay off a large loan of almost 1 million sesterces to Julius Caesar before the outbreak of civil war made it embarrassing. So what were the sources of Cicero's income? How had he moved from a reasonably affluent local background to being one of the rich, even if far from the richest, at Rome? Some hints in the letters helped to sketch out part of the picture. First, a negative. There is no sign that Cicero had any major trading or commercial interests. Strictly speaking, senators were banned from overseas trade, and the wealth of the political elite at Rome was always officially defined by and rooted in land. Nonetheless, some senatorial families profited from commercial ventures indirectly, whether through non-senatorial relations or by using their ex-slaves as frontmen. The family of the same Publius Cestius, the senator with whom Cicero joked about his debt, is one of the best examples of this. Thousands of wine amphorae of the early to mid-first century BCE stamped SES, or SEST, have been discovered across the Mediterranean from Spain to Athens, with a particular concentration in southern Gaul, including some 1,700 in a shipwreck off Marseille. These are the clear traces of a large commercial export business associated with some members of the Cestius family, who are known to have had estates near the northern Italian town of Cosa, where another concentration of the same kind of amphorae with the same stamp has been found. Whoever was formerly in charge of the business, the profits surely seeped through to the senatorial Cestii too. But there are no hints that Cicero had any involvement in anything like that, apart from a few snobbish and inaccurate slurs made by his enemies that his father had been in the laundry business. Some of Cicero's money came quite traditionally from rents and from the products of his agricultural land, boosted by the property that was part of Terentia's diary. But he had two other main sources of substantial funds. The first was inheritances from outside his immediate family. In 44 BCE, he claimed to have received in all a vast 20 million sesterces by that route. It is impossible now to identify all of the benefactors, but many of these legacies must have been paybacks from those he had helped in various ways, ex-slaves who had made their own fortunes or satisfied clients whom he had represented in court. Roman lawyers were expressly forbidden to receive fees for their services. And it is often rightly said, what Cicero gained by pleading in high-profile cases was public prominence. Yet often there were financial returns in some indirect form too. Publius Sulla, the nephew of the dictator, can hardly have been unusual in rewarding Cicero for a successful defence in court. He lent 2 million sesterces towards the purchase of the Palatine House, and repayment seems not to have been demanded. The other source was Cicero's province. While boasting, maybe correctly, that he had never broken the law in extorting money from the provincials, he still left Cilicia in 50 BC with more than 2 million sesterces in local currency in his luggage. How exactly it was acquired is not certain. A combination, perhaps, of Cicero's meanness with his expense allowance and the profits from his minor victory, including selling off the captives into slavery afterwards. Rather than transport this money back to Italy, he deposited it on his way home with a company of Publicani in Ephesus, apparently envisaging some form of cashless transfer of funds. But the civil war soon derailed whatever long-term plans he had for it. In early 48 BCE, Pompey's war fund needed all the cash it could get, and Cicero agreed to lend this 2 million sesterces to him, which presumably went some way towards making up for his irritating behaviour in camp. There is no suggestion that he ever got the money back. This profit of a war against a foreign enemy had ended up, as many others did, bankrolling a war of Roman against Roman. Human property. There were also human beings among Cicero's property. In the letters, he mentions in all just over 20 slaves, a group of 6 or 7 message boys, a few secretaries, clerks, and readers who read books or documents aloud for the convenience of their master, as well as an attendant, a workman, a cook, a manservant, and an accountant or two. In practice, his household must have been much bigger than this. The servicing of 20 properties suggests an absolute minimum staff of 200, even if some were just small lodges and others were mothballed for months on end. There were gardens to be tended, repairs to be carried out, furnaces to be stoked, security to be arranged, not to mention fields to be tilled on the working farms. It says a lot about the invisibility of slaves to the master that Cicero pays no attention to the vast majority of them. Most of those he does mention in his letters are, like the message boys and secretaries, concerned with the production and delivery of the letters themselves. At a very rough guess, there might have been between 1.5 and 2 million slaves in Italy in the middle of the 1st century BCE, making up perhaps 20% of the total population. They shared the single defining characteristic of being human property in someone else's ownership. But that apart, they were just as varied in background and style of life as free citizens. There was no such thing as a typical slave. Some in Cicero's possession would have been enslaved abroad after defeat in war. Some would have been the product of a ruthless trade that made its profit by trafficking people from the margins of the empire. Others would have been rescued from a rubbish tip or born as slaves in-house to slave women. Increasingly over the next centuries, as the scale of the wars of Roman conquest diminished, it was this home breeding that became the major source of supply, so consigning slave women to much the same regime of childbearing as their free counterparts. More generally, slaves' conditions of life and work varied from cruel and cramped to borderline luxury. The 50 pokey slave cubicles under the grand house of Scaurus were not the worst a slave would fear. Some in larger industrial or agricultural operations would have been more or less kept in captivity. Many would have been beaten. In fact, the vulnerability to corporal punishment was one of the things that made a slave a slave. Whipping boy was one of their common nicknames. Yet there were also a few, a small minority, who bulked largest in the surviving evidence, whose day-to-day lifestyle might have seemed enviable to the poor, free, and hungry Roman citizen. By their standards, the slave aides of wealthy men in luxurious mansions, their private doctors or literary advisers, usually educated slaves of Greek origin, lived cosseted lives. The attitudes of the free population to their slaves and to slavery as an institution were equally varied and ambivalent. For the owner's disdain and sadism sat side by side with a degree of fear and anxiety about their dependence and vulnerability, which numerous popular sayings and anecdotes capture. All slaves are enemies, was one piece of Roman wisdom. And in the reign of the Emperor Nero, when someone had the bright idea to make slaves wear uniforms, it was rejected on the grounds that this would make clear to the slave population just how numerous they were. Yet any attempt to draw clear and consistent lines between slave and free, or to define the inferiority of slaves, were they things rather than people, some ancient theorists rather desperately wondered, was necessarily thwarted by social practice. Slaves and free in many contexts worked closely together. In the ordinary workshop, slaves might be friends and confidants as well as human chattel. And they were part of the Roman family. The Latin word familia always included the non-free and the free members of the household. For many, slavery was in any case only a temporary status, which added to the conceptual confusion. The Roman habit of freeing so many slaves may have been driven by all kinds of coldly practical considerations. It was certainly cheaper, for example, to give slaves their freedom than to keep them in their unproductive old age. But this was one crucial aspect of the widespread image of Rome as an open culture, and it made the Roman citizen body the most ethnically diverse that there ever was before the modern world. And it was a further cause for cultural anxiety. Were Romans freeing too many slaves? They asked. Were they freeing them for the wrong reasons? And what was the consequence of that for any idea of Romanness? In most cases, when Cicero notices his slaves more than in passing, it is because something has gone wrong, and his reactions reveal some of these ambivalences and tensions in a day-to-day setting. In 46 BCE, he wrote to one of his friends, then the governor of the province of Illyricum, on the eastern coast of the Adriatic. He had a problem with his librarian. A slave by the name of Dionysius had been pilfering his books and then, fearing that he would be exposed, had scarped. It turned out that Dionysius had been spotted in Illyricum, perhaps near his original home, where he had apparently claimed that Cicero had given him his freedom. "It's not a big thing," Cicero admitted, "but it's a weight on my mind." He was asking that his friend keep an eye out, to no avail, it seems. A year later, he heard from the next governor that your runaway has gone to ground among a local people, the Vardei, but nothing was ever heard of him again, even though Cicero fantasized about seeing him brought back to Rome and led as a captive in a triumphal procession. He had had the same kind of trouble with an ex-slave a few years earlier, another librarian, he explains in a letter to Atticus. This Chrysippus, with his wonderfully learned Greek name, best known from a 3rd century BCE philosopher, had been given the job of accompanying Cicero's son, Marcus, then in his mid-teens, and Marcus's slightly older cousin, back to Rome from Cilicia. At some point on the journey, Chrysippus abandoned the young men. Never mind all his minor pilferings, Cicero exploded, it was simply absconding that he could not stand, as ex-slaves, even after being granted their freedom, were still supposed to have obligations to their ex-master. Cicero's reaction was to use a legal technicality to cancel Chrysippus's freedom and re-enslave him. Too little, too late, of course. Chrysippus was already off. It is hard to judge the accuracy of Cicero's version of these stories. How easy was it to sell on stolen books in Rome? Had Dionysius used them to finance his escape? Did Cicero believe he still had them with him? There was probably even less of a market among the Vardei. Or was the theft more a product of Cicero's paranoia and obsession with his library? Whatever the truth, these stories offer a useful antidote to the Spartacus model of slave discontent and resistance. Very few slaves came head-to-head with Roman authority, still less with the Roman legions. Most resisted their master, like this pair did, by just running away, going to ground, and, if challenged, saying to their questioner, who almost certainly knew no better, that they had been freed anyway. On Cicero's side, this offers the image of a man for whom his slave household really could be the enemy within, even if that mostly came down to light fingers, and for whom the difference between those slaves he had freed and those he had not was narrower than many modern historians want to make it. It should be no surprise that, although libertus is the standard Latin term for an ex-slave, on numerous occasions the word servus, slave, is used for both. The one big exception to this picture is found in Cicero's relationship with his slave secretary, Tiro, the man who in the medieval imagination was credited with the invention of a well-known form of shorthand. Tiro's origins are entirely unknown, unless the far-fetched Roman gossip was right to suspect that Cicero was so fond of him he could only have been Cicero's natural son. He was freed with much celebration in 54 or 53 BCE to become a Roman citizen under the name of Marcus Tullius Tiro. The relationship of Tiro with the whole Cicero family has often been seen as the acceptable face of Roman slavery. Many of the family's letters to him, no replies, survive, brim with affection, chat, and often concern about his health. "Your health makes us terribly worried," Quintus Cicero wrote, typically in 49 BCE, "and it's an enormous worry that you are going to be away from us for so long. But really don't commit yourself to a long journey unless you are good and strong." And the occasion of Tiro's grant of freedom was marked by joyous congratulation and self-congratulation. Quintus again, writing to his brother from Gaul, where he was serving with Julius Caesar, captures something of the significance of the change of status. "I am really pleased with what you have done about Tiro, and that you decided